Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I think it's about pleasing people. You know, it's getting people around the table. You have this great conviviality. And if you have really good food and you invite the right people, they're your adoring fans forever.
Judith Dern of AllRecipes.com talks Thanksgiving with us today. How to salvage an undercooked pie crust, catering to your guests' dietary needs, updating family traditions. We cover a variety of topics to get you ready for the big meal. Two recipes with Chef Daniel Orr, both with similar flavor profiles, mulled wine and spiced apple granita. And from Harvest Public Media, how all the players in today's food debates are using science to bolster their claims. Luann Johnson here with five stories from the week's food news.
Typhoon Haiyan touched down last Friday, killing more than 10,000 people. Survivors are growing desperate for aid. Hard-hit areas in need of aid are often impassable by car due to the destruction, and flights in and out of the country are limited due to damaged control towers. Some aid arrived Wednesday to relief points Tacloban and Jian. Charities are encouraging donations of cash instead of in-kind gifts like clothing. The FDA announced its plan to ban partially hydrogenated vegetable oils from all food products, better known as trans fats. The main concern is that trans fats raise the risk of heart disease. NPR reports that the CDC estimates the ban could prevent an additional 7,000 deaths from heart disease each year and up to 20,000 heart attacks annually. Most restaurants and food companies eliminated or reduced trans fats years ago after the FDA required them to label foods that contain trans fats. That was in 2006. By 2012, Americans consumed around 1 gram per day, down from 4.6 grams of trans fats daily in 2003. Trans fats are often added to foods to improve the texture, shelf life, or flavor. More about your health. 8.4% of the world's adult population is living with diabetes. That's 382 million people this year, a new record. That's according to a new report from the International Diabetes Federation. Since the majority of cases are type 2 diabetes, researchers point to more people in the developing world adopting Western urban lifestyles as the cause of the increase. The country with the most diabetics overall is China, over 98 million people currently. Looking ahead to 2035, the organization predicts the number of cases globally will soar to 592 million. Thanks to a new agreement, the Let's Move campaign has introduced Sesame Street icons to market fruits and vegetables to children. The agreement will allow characters like Elmo and Big Bird to promote produce without charging licensing. The hope is that their presence on packages of vegetables will make those foods more appealing to youngsters. In support of the initiative, First Lady Michelle Obama cited a Cornell University experiment where children were given a choice between an apple and a cookie. Researchers found that they were able to double the likelihood of kids choosing the apple just by affixing an Elmo sticker to its peel. Another recent study, this one conducted by the Yale Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity, looked at trends in fast food marketing geared toward young consumers. Results, unfortunately, were mostly discouraging. While there was a decline in the amount of fast food commercials seen by children on the television, the average kid is still exposed to between 3 and 5 such TV ads per day. In addition, marketing via social media and mobile devices has increased exponentially. Elmo and Big Bird, you've got your work cut out for you. And the Food Safety Modernization Act was signed into law 2 years ago, but it's back in the news as the rules are set to go into effect in a couple weeks. The law tightens regulations for growing produce, and it gives the FDA power to respond to food safety issues. While this sounds like a win for public health, some organic farmers are worried it will increase their costs to the point of financial ruin. One point of the law would require farmers to wait for their compost to become, quote, safe before applying it to fields. It would also require them to keep records of their compost use, which would increase operational costs. The comment period on the law ends this week, and then the rules go into effect on November 30. You can read an article in Forbes by Beth Hoffman to get a better understanding of why farmers are worried. Find a link to that on our website, eartheats.org.
The link is located in this week's podcast post. That's where you'll find it. Some important stories this week for sure. Find more news on Twitter and Facebook. Connect with us at Earth Eats. Lou Anne Johnson, thanks.
My pleasure.
Hot-button food issues of the day, such as the use of genetically modified organisms or the treatment of livestock, tend to pit large industries against smaller activist groups. As Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, both sides like to claim science supports what they're saying, and that leaves consumers in a bit of a bind.
Let's take the GMO question as an example. Genetic modification of seeds is widely used in the United States, but remains controversial. Some European and African countries have banned the use of GM seeds. Many people question their safety and environmental impact. So when the 2013 World Food Prize, an award for innovation in food production, recently went to three pioneers of the technology, one of the most ardent opponents of it came to Des Moines to join a World Food Prize symposium on the question.
Why accept the invitation from the World Food Prize to participate in this?
Well, I thought it would be a whole lot easier not to, and so I felt that I should.
That's Frances Moore LePay of the Small Planet Institute. She's been writing about and working on food, hunger, and environmental issues for more than four decades. She says many scientific studies raise questions about GMOs. She cites some in her fact sheet called Seven Really Good Reasons to Rethink GMOs.
We have a link to all of the sources that we use, and we have excerpts from the studies so that people can see how we interpret them because it's a two-page fact sheet. So I know that there are very serious scientists who've done experiments that raise questions for them about safety.
But another activist, Mark Linus, disagrees, though he once radically opposed modified crops.
I've destroyed GM maize, canola, sugar beet. Maybe one or two others. It was dark, so you can't always tell.
Nearly 20 years ago, Linus participated in direct action campaigns against GMOs. But earlier this year, he announced he'd changed his mind. Now, he says he accepts what he sees as a scientific consensus that GMOs in food are safe.
All of these are questions which are very directly addressed many times over, independently and through funds and through studies which are conducted by the industry and then assessed by the regulators. There's only so many times you can ask the same question and get the same answer.
Consumers think that science is definitive. But I think the important thing to remember is that science is a process.
University of Wisconsin-Madison consumer science professor Lydia Zepeda says studies may use different designs or types of analyses or even start with different questions. And that means they can legitimately arrive at conflicting results. Zepeda says that places a burden on consumers.
How can consumers be expected to know more than scientists? I think the bottom line is they can't.
With both sides claiming the support of scientific studies, where does that leave the rest of us? Zepeda's tip to consumers is follow the money. Greater transparency could help everyone. More openness about who funds scientific research and about who pays for activist campaigns. But Zepeda has another suggestion, too.
People may have gotten into their positions, but they still might want to listen to each other.
Because if you listen, you can hear where even these two adversaries have much in common when they stop disputing each other's scientific claims. Here's Moore LePay again.
The beauty of agroecology, that approach of applying ecological science, it's not anti-science, it's applying science to farming, is that it empowers farmers through building their knowledge.
I am all for diversity, right? I'm all for agroecology, I'm all for organic farming, but at the same time, if some farmers want to use BT crops which are resistant to pests and reduce their use of pesticides that way, then they should have the option to do that.
That was Linus addressing the World Food Prize Symposium. On GMOs and on other food issues, the activists will continue their campaigns. For consumers, trying to understand the science may not be necessary or helpful. Figuring out who's paying for it might help some people. But Zepeda says her science shows that the biggest influence on our purchases is habit. I'm Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. the biggest meal of the year, and it's right around the corner. We caught up with Judith Dern of AllRecipes.com on Skype to get us thinking about Thanksgiving. We asked you, our Twitter followers, to tell us your greatest concerns about cooking Thanksgiving dinner. First, a bit of advice. Despite all your concerns with the cooking, don't forsake your duties as host.
I think it's about pleasing people. You know, it's getting people around the table. You have this great conviviality. And if you have really good food and you invite the right people, they're your adoring fans forever.
Well, this is a perfect time to talk about one of the questions we got on Twitter. Someone is just deeply concerned about pleasing everybody at her table. I can't imagine that you have tips for how to please everyone that's going to come to Thanksgiving, but maybe ideas to calm her nerves?
That, I think, is a trick. There's so many different dietary restrictions. It can concern and disorient even the most experienced cook. So I would tell her to relax. And if people are really, really concerned about what they can and can't eat, have them bring their own food. Because I think it's a special meal. You can cook things that are vegetarian. You could have one or two dishes that would fit that criteria. But if it's something that is really concerning someone, they should go the extra mile and not expect the host to.
This makes me think of something else. Like, how much of the cook's responsibility is it to cater to everyone's needs? Or if, let's say, you're a gluten-free vegan, is it your responsibility to contact the person who's cooking for you to say, hey, here are my needs?
I think most hosts are pretty savvy and they do ask, you know, if someone has dietary restrictions. Because it's better to know in advance than to be surprised and have people disappointed.
People living on a budget, aren't we all? So the parts of a Thanksgiving meal that you can save money on and the parts of the meal that you should, you know, expect to pay a lot and realize that you're getting good quality because you're paying a lot.
You know, Thanksgiving, I think it's because of the size, the proportions, because people are cooking or maybe cooking for a good crowd that makes it seem like an expensive meal. But when you break it down, it's really not. I would try to put it in perspective that way. But if you are trying to save money, then certainly ask your guests to bring a dish. If you have recipes you want them to make, there's nothing wrong with telling them and having them do that. And you don't have to have 69 different size dishes. You know, you can be perfectly fine with mashed potatoes, a vegetable dish, gravy, and cranberry sauce. You don't have to, you know, break the budget by going all out.
Side dishes. We'll talk more about those in the second half of our show. When going to someone's house for dinner, I know I tend to bring a bottle of wine with me. This Thanksgiving, ask your guests to bring some wine that's maybe not their favorite. Maybe they've had a bottle that's been sitting on the rack for too long. Not good to serve with the meal, but Chef Daniel Orr says perfect for mulled wine.
Mulled wines were traditionally had in the wintertime, and it was a way that you could use up old wine that didn't taste very good. So you'd add all these spices and some sweeteners like honey or whatever sweetener, brown sugar, and you would sweeten them up a bit. And basically it's the same ingredients for the mulled wine and a hot apple cider. So what we have here is I've got about 3 bottles. We're expecting a lot of people to come in tonight. All right, we're going to add about 2 cups of brown sugar, and we're going to add some honey. Again, you don't want to use one of your really good kind of designer honeys, like, you know, you might be buying a really good expensive local honey. This is going to get lost in the red wine. So you can use a more generic wildflower type honey. Okay, and now we're just going to add our spices. What we're going to do to make this easier to serve so you don't have a bunch of UFOs flying around in your mulled cider is that we're going to take cheesecloth and make a sachet out of it. So we've got some au poivre blend, which is a blend of 5 peppercorns. We've got some cloves, some star anise, and star anise is that really nice Asian ingredient that tastes a lot like licorice, and if you smell this, it's got that really nice sweet licorice-y flavor. I've got some bay leaves, a little bit of coriander seeds, some fennel seeds, some cinnamon sticks, which I just like to break up just a little bit. And we're going to put some thyme. Now, this is some thyme that I got out of my garden right before the first big heavy freeze came. I went out there and grabbed as much thyme as I could, put that in the refrigerator in a Ziploc bag with a little bit of wet paper towel, and it's kept for about a month and a half. A couple big hunks of ginger.
And your favorite ginger.
Yeah, and some cardamom. And now we're just going to tie this up.
Oh, it's a little package.
Yeah, we call it a sachet. Now, I'm using a crock pot for this, but you could do this right on the stove in a nice heavy bottom stainless steel pan. You don't want to use aluminum for this because aluminum, with the acid of the wine, some of the aluminum might leach out into it. So anytime you're doing something that's going to be acidic, like a tomato sauce or a wine sauce, you always want to use stainless steel instead of aluminum. And we're just going to sink that in there. I'm going to float some nice oranges on top of this. And we're just going to let that mull for 45 minutes to an hour. The way I like to serve this is to take my little drink glass, and you want to use a very heat-resistant glassware or mug. What we're going to do is we're just going to dip it in a little bit of that honey, and then we're going to dip this into cinnamon sugar.
Oh, look at that.
And you've got a nice little spiced, rimmed glass. It shows a little bit more thought and care into what you're doing for your guests, and it's all about nurturing the friends and family that you invite over to celebrate with. So that's our hot drink of the day.
This recipe, along with photos of Chef Orr behind the bar at eartheats.org. Coming up, it pays to have help in the kitchen.
And then I've got all these ingredients, and you can see that they're all labeled very precisely. That means the pastry chef has probably been involved, because cooks are not that precise.
Daniel Orr makes us a sweet treat using basically the same flavors as that mulled wine. Be right back. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all four locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. This is Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Apples, apple cider, brown sugar, spiced rum. Let's do this.
And what do you think it's going to be?
Something sweet and delicious.
Yeah. This is going to be a granite or a granita. And that means a frozen ice, like an Italian ice, a shaved ice. Basically, granita comes from granite, the stone granite that kind of, when you smash it, it kind of shaves off into little flakes. And so that's why the Italians call it a granita and the French call it a granite. And we're going to make that very easily. We've got a pot here, and then I've got all these ingredients, and you can see that they're all labeled very precisely. That means the pastry chef has probably been involved, because cooks are not that precise. So we've got 3 cups of apple cider. You know, the pastry being so much more kind of chemical, and you've got to follow recipes, and cooks do everything by taste, so it's a little bit different. All right, so I've got the 3 cups cider. Use your best local cider that you can find. I've got 1 cup of packed brown sugar. We've got a 1/2 teaspoon of sweet seasons, which is one of my spice blends, as well as a 1/2 teaspoon of allspice. These are basically kind of the same flavors you're going to find in a mull cider. We've got a 1/2 teaspoon of cloves,
And then I've got two cinnamon sticks. And what we're going to do is we're going to bring this to a boil and let that sugar dissolve. And we'll be right back after that.
While we wait on the Granita, back to our Skype conversation with Judith Dern in Seattle. She's the Senior Communications Manager of AllRecipes.com.
And I have to confess that my kitchen may be under construction at Thanksgiving. So I'm probably going to be an orphan, and I've been thinking about which friends to ask to invite me over.
She can offer pecan and pumpkin pies in exchange. Speaking of pie, she says it just wouldn't be Thanksgiving for her if she didn't have her pecan pie.
And I have a recipe that I've been making since high school. It's really simple. It's, you know, it does have Cairo syrup. It does have the pecans arranged in concentric circles around the top. And if I don't have that, I really feel like something's missing.
I've got pecan pie on the brain because you talked about that before. So got a crumbly or undercooked pie crust, just a pie crust that is no good. Is there anything you can do?
Probably not, but there are some things that you can do to sort of save the day. And one is to scoop out the filling and put it into little cups or parfait glasses and top with some whipped cream or vanilla ice cream. So you have more of a Thanksgiving parfait. There are things you can do in advance to make sure your pie crust doesn't get undercooked. One thing I always recommend is find a high heat ceramic pie dish. Glass conducts heat the least well. So if a ceramic dish isn't available, then I would look for an aluminum pie pan because that's also a very good conductor of heat. And some of it is just practice. If you're making your own pie crust for the first time, it could be touch and go. And there's nothing wrong with buying a prepared pie crust either. But always start the oven at 425 for 15 minutes. Let the pie cook at that temperature and then turn it down for 350 or 325 for the remainder of the cooking time. And you can also put your pie tin on a baking sheet, which will help conduct the heat as well.
I was wondering if you were going to give us permission to buy a pie crust. I appreciate that.
Yes. Yes. It's like, it's a stressful day. If that's an easy shortcut, then go for it.
Let's talk about tradition. You said pecan pie is part of your tradition. You got to have it for Thanksgiving. Let's say you want to mix it up somehow this year, but you realize that you have family traditions. You don't want to forsake the traditions that people are expecting, but you also want to try something new. Parts of the meal that you feel like you could switch up, do something new?
Certainly with side dishes, there are a lot of options. People may or may not like Brussels sprouts, but you can toss those with toasted walnuts and apple slices. You could mix some cheddar, you know, some white cheddar cheese into your mashed potatoes. Also add a good scoop of sour cream into mashed potatoes. That really smooths them out and adds a little richness to the flavor. And then don't forget the green bean casserole.
Why do you say that?
It's such a classic. You know, it comes up every year as one of the top side dishes. And even though it, you know, it's using canned mushroom soup and all of that, it's still something people have to have.
Is there anything else we forgot to talk about today?
I guess we didn't talk about gravy.
Let's do it. It's my favorite part, so we got to do it.
Yeah, that's something that may be the trickiest part, even more than the turkey.
The gravy?
Yes. Okay. Some people have, you know, gravy paranoia.
Okay.
But it's, you're using the stock and the drippings from the turkey in the bottom of the pan, and you can make gravy while the turkey is resting before you carve it. What you want to do is take those drippings and have some broth that's hot, and then you're going to thicken that using either flour or cornstarch. And the trick is to thicken, to take a little bit of cornstarch with a little bit of the broth and stir them together on a 1-to-1 proportion. So start with 1 tablespoon of flour and 1 tablespoon of the liquid and mix that together until it's thoroughly blended, and then slowly whisk it into your drippings and the hot broth liquid. And I always recommend using a whisk because I think it makes it a lot easier to blend the two things.
You make it sound so easy. Why do people have gravy paranoia? That sounds about as straightforward as you can get.
Because it can get pretty lumpy if you don't mix it thoroughly before you add it to your main meat drippings. If you don't use a fork or a whisk to make that cornstarch broth mixture smooth, then it can get lumpy when you add it.
Aha.
It is lumpy. Get out the whisk or get out a fork.
And just go and to town.
Yeah, that will help you smooth out the lumps.
More tips from Judith Dern and allrecipes.com on their website. Watch their 12 videos that will help you be this year's Thanksgiving hero. Next week, the most important part of the meal, the turkey, you'll want to hear Judith's very easy step-by-step instructions. Dessert is nearing completion.
Pouring that through a strainer to get the cinnamon sticks out and the cloves. And now we're going to add a couple more ingredients. We have 2 ounces of spiced rum, a dark rum, and we have 1 tablespoon of real vanilla extract. Okay, we're going to stir this in. All right, now we're going to put that in the freezer, and we're going to let that freeze for a minimum of 3 to 4 hours, or even better, overnight. And it's great if you have time to get in there with a fork every once in a while once it starts to freeze and just kind of rake it around and start building those kind of Italian ice crystals. Yeah, we have some ready. Now I'm just going to shave it into those ice crystals. And if sometimes, depending on what kind of cider, how sweet it is, it may be a little bit syrupy or not get real crunchy. If that happens to you, just add a little bit of water to it and throw it back in the freezer, and that will allow you to get those ice crystals going. Okay, and to serve this, you could serve it over, fruit compote if you'd like, or you could even layer it in a glass with some vanilla ice cream would be good. But we're just going to serve it fresh with some apple slices. And I've got a frozen glass bowl and ice in the middle standing up. And then I can garnish it with a little mint out of the garden. And there you go, very simple make-ahead dessert, spiced apple cider granite. Hope you enjoy that this holiday season.
Specifically over Thanksgiving, when apples are still being picked fresh from the tree, recipes like this one and plenty of others to add to your Thanksgiving menu at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alfred, Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Judith Dern, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Chef Daniel Orr, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 4 locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years. Building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Another Thanksgiving-themed show next week. Love this time of year. Thanks for being here. I'm Annie Corrigan.